This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more.
The debate.
Hi everybody, a warm welcome to the debate. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. Now, based on an American political journalism company, the U.S. is going to offer a new plan to encourage Iran to go back to the negotiating table. Of course, that would require Tehran to stop part of its nuclear activities and return for some relief from Washington's unilateral sanctions. An Iranian-informed source told Press TV on Monday that Tehran is not going to accept the new proposal that Washington is set to be preparing to put forth soon. Tehran saying for the nuclear deal to be revived, Washington only needs to make a political decision. It doesn't have to come up with any new plans.
A senior Iranian official said that Tehran will stop its 20% uranium enrichment only if the U.S. lifts all its sanctions on the Islamic Republic first. The official said Tehran will further reduce its commitments under the 2015 nuclear deal if the U.S. does not end all sanctions, warning that Washington is rapidly running out of time. The remarks are in response to a report published in Politico that said Washington is to offer a new proposal to Tehran to jumpstart the talks on the nuclear deal as soon as this week. This comes as the Iranian president has already rejected the notion of talks on the nuclear deal. Hassan Rouhani said, since Washington did not sit for talks when it left the deal, its return to the agreement also merits no negotiations, but a mere political will.
The proposal asks Iran to halt some of its nuclear activities, such as work on advanced centrifuges and the enrichment of uranium to 20% purity in exchange for some relief from U.S. economic sanctions.
After a year of full compliance with the agreement following U.S. withdrawal, Iran gradually started to scale down its nuclear deal commitments because the European parties to the accord, under pressure from the U.S., failed to meet their obligations. Iran says its countermeasures conform to the terms of the deal that allows one side to reduce commitments when others do not honor theirs. Since taking office, U.S. President Joe Biden has followed his predecessor Donald Trump's policies vis-a-vis the Iran nuclear deal, officially known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. Experts believe U.S. policies toward Iran have always been hostile, irrespective of who is in charge of the White House.
The U.S. is determined to overthrow the Iranian government, but it cannot overthrow the Iranian government. And so here we have a situation where the U.S. policy can't really succeed, and the U.S. politicians won't back away from a consensus position that exists within the American establishment.
The Biden team has repeatedly said Washington is open to talks with Tehran, stressing that the ball is in Iran's court to revive the accord. Washington says Iran must first return to full compliance and the U.S. would then rejoin the accord. Iran has, however, rejected the U.S. position, stressing that Washington must take the first step and lift all sanctions because it was the U.S. that left the agreement in the first place. The Iranian president maintained that the remarks by Iran's leader make it very clear that Tehran would fulfill all its commitments if and only if the U.S. returns to its obligations under the deal.
All right, Ned, with that report, let's get down to business. So joining me in this debate will be from the Answer Coalition, Richard Becker, out of San Francisco. And also we'll have author and former U.S. diplomat Michael Springman joining us out of Washington, D.C. Good to have both of you gentlemen on the show. Let's go to Richard. Americans have told Politico that all they are trying to do is to get the conversation started between the U.S. and Iran. Now, reacting to that report, an Iran-informed source told Press TV that what the U.S. needs to do is just to undo the sanctions. They don't need to take the trouble and come up with new plans. Isn't that right?
Well, I think so. The present existing administration is an extension of the United States government and the United States government that under Trump drew, and I think drew illegally from this agreement, It was an act of great irresponsibility, with the idea coming from Trump and his advisors that this would lead to the downfall of the Iranian government, which of course it has, and it has not achieved anything of what the United States government is trying to do, except, and I think this is a big except to really cause more suffering among the Iranian people. The idea of these sanctions, whether the sanctions against Iran or Iraq, which I witnessed personally, or Cuba, which I have witnessed personally the effects of, or against Venezuela, all these sanctions against North Korea, many other countries, are meant to cause those countries to become weaker. The idea that they lead to the overthrow of the governments is just ridiculous. But they do cause great, great suffering among the people. Really, I believe that sanctions should be, these kind of economic sanctions should be considered to be crimes against humanity. But it's certainly the responsibility of the United States government to return to the position that was adopted under the JCPOA, and that called for the lifting of sanctions, U.S. and U.N. sanctions against Iran.
Now, Michael, the new proposal wants Iran to stop part of its nuclear activities, like working advanced centrifuges and also uranium enrichment to 20% purity, and that in exchange for some relief from U.S. sanctions. Now, Rankin official told Press TV that Tehran is not going to accept that offer. Iran has clearly asserted its stance, and that is verifiable lifting of all the U.S. sanctions before anything else. Let's have your comments on that.
Well, my comments are basically that the introductory report pretty much said everything except the fact that you can use the old saying, fool me once, shame on you, fool me twice, shame on me. The Iranians have seen what the Americans have said and what the Americans have actually done. And they've seen that the sanctions have not been lifted despite change of administrations. What's not been said is the controls and the connections that the apartheid entity that styles itself Israel is deeply involved with both the Trump and the Biden administrations. Joseph Robinette Biden Jr. has children married to Jews. His Secretary of State is a Jew. The Deputy Secretary of State is a Jew. The Deputy Secretary and Deputy Director of the Central Intelligence Agency is a Jew. And the Director of National Intelligence is a Jew. And as Jonathan Pollard said recently, Jews have one loyalty to Israel, no other country whatsoever. So I think that what we've got is a continuation of Israel's policy to try and destroy Iran. The Israelis don't like to have Iran to have any kind of long-range missiles. They object to Iranians questioning this constant inspection of the country on a surprise basis, which is going to expire at the end of May. The Biden administration claims it doesn't want to do anything at all about making the first step in renegotiating or bringing about a reinstitution of the JCPOA, because it might offend some Republicans in Congress. And all of this is nonsense. And the basics of it, of course, are that there is no JCPOA aimed at Israel, which has an uncounted number of nuclear weapons, an uncounted amount of poison gas, and an uncounted amount of deadly bacteria. Everything is aimed at Iran. Everything is discussed about Iran. But Israel and Saudi Arabia and India and Pakistan, for example, are not involved in any of this. The British are expanding their nuclear warfare capabilities with new submarines, and nobody says a word about that, but it's always Iran, Iran, Iran. And as the Germans say, Quatsch, which is a very strongly worded expression for stuff and nonsense that borders on the vulgar.
Okay. Now let's go to San Francisco to Richard. Iran's UN ambassador has also echoed the same reaction by saying that in order for the U.S. to return to the JCPOA, nothing is needed but the White House's political decision to fulfill its commitments under the deal it wants to, let's say, revive. Now, do you think the U.S. will return to the deal and will comply with its commitments, or has Biden already chosen an arm-twisting approach towards Tehran?
Well, Well, let me first of all say, and I must say this, is that I do not agree in any way, shape, or form with the idea that Israel is dictating U.S. foreign policy, or that because of the religion of certain top officials in the U.S. government, that this is what's directing U.S. policy. I think that's a really anti-Semitic line. And I think it's one that really does great disservice to those of us who, and the rest of people everywhere who are calling for an end to the U.S. policy against Iran. The U.S. is the most far-flung empire that's ever existed. It has bases, more than 800 bases all over the world, no country has ever had before. And the idea that a small country, a relatively small but militarily powerful, because the U.S. has built up Israel, and that is the reason that the U.S. supports Israel, because Israel is really part of the U.S. war machine. It's not because of Jewish people or sympathy for Jewish people or anything like that. Whether or not this is going to continue with the Biden administration going forward with its policy, apparently going forward with the policy of seeking more concessions from Iran before agreeing to return to the conditions of the JCPOA. And I must say, the conditions of the JCPOA were quite onerous for Iran. It's not like it was some great victories, you know, or Iran got all the good things from it. No, it's not. It was I think it was a compromise that was very seriously debated inside the Iranian parliament and the Iranian political establishment as a whole. So the idea that Iran should have to make more concessions, should have to do something else before the U.S. would agree to return to the JCPOA and to lift the sanctions, is really a step way too far to expect from Iran. And also, we know that the Iranian presidential election is coming up. I believe it's coming up in June. And that of course, affects the position of...
Yeah, I'm going to ask about it, too, yeah. Okay, let's go back to D.C. Michael, Joe Biden kept lashing out at Donald Trump for pulling out of the Iran nuclear deal during his presidential campaign, but Biden has done nothing practically to revive the deal 2 months into his administration. How do you explain this inconsistency and contradiction?
Well, basically because he says he's a proud supporter of Israel. And, of course, Israel is America's oldest enemy and greatest debtor. They control the... state governments in the United States, to the extent that 26 of them have passed resolutions and laws against boycott, divestment, and sanction. They even control high school and college textbook content in the United States. So Biden, with his Zionist relatives and with his strong support of Israel, which he's announced over the years, is the main reason behind this. I think any criticism of Israel is automatically branded as anti-Semitic, which, frankly, I got to say is botch again. So I think that Biden will not take any kind of steps throughout his administration because of his strong support of Israel and its illegitimacy and its murder, war crimes, and human rights violations. So I think that Biden has got to change his mind, if he has a mind, given some of the things he's done and said recently. So I think that we've got to get rid of Biden. We've got to get rid of half his administration, which are retreads from Clinton and the Obama administrations. And we've got to get some people in there who know what they're doing, who understand the real world, and who are not beholden to any foreign entity.
Okay. Now, let me ask Richard Becker. Richard, as you know, Tehran recently signed this 3-month agreement with the IAEA, and that will expire in late May. And Iran regards this deal as a window of opportunity for U.S. and also European signatories to the JCPOA to take this opportunity and do what's necessary to do regarding the deal, if they really want to revive it as they claim it. Would they benefit from this chance and really take some action and do something in order to see this thing rolling again?
Well, I think that if they don't, take some real action, that the United States will become more and more isolated here. We know that China and Iran just signed long-term strategic agreement for development, for trade, and so forth. And while the United States is still the dominant military power in the world, and as I said, has bases all over the world, military bases, which are generally unwelcome by people who live around them. It's not a pleasant experience to live right by a military base with all the training and so forth. And it's an infringement on the sovereignty of so many different countries. But while that's going on, you have China going forward with making agreements with many countries for actual development projects for maybe as many or more countries now, including Iran. So you can see the United States, and I think this poses a particular danger, I have to say this, is that the U.S. is becoming more isolated and weakened internationally, except in the area of, and maybe not even to say except, but its main strength is a military strength. And that means that because the determination of the U.S. leaders is to maintain global domination, to be the dominant power in the world, according to the national security strategy, that the threat of war is a very real threat against Iran, against China, against Russia. And so we have to look at that. But if the U.S., if its U.S. allies don't take some real action like they pledged to when the JCPOA was reneged on by the United States, then they too will have forfeited an opportunity to put an end to this situation that exists now in regards to Iran. Mm-hmm.
Now, Michael, as for Iran's remedial measures, you know that they started a year after former President Trump pulled his country out of the JCPOA. And what Iran has done has been based on paragraph 36 of the nuclear deal. Now, those measures can all stop immediately, provided the U.S. lifts the sanctions. Now, anything ambiguous about this?
Not at all. It's very, very clear. It was quite clear that the United States broke the agreement, and it says in the agreement that if one country breaks it, the other countries are not bound by it. And the Iranians have repeatedly said, after a year of waiting and waiting and waiting for American non-action, to say that, okay, we will take steps that were enjoined under the original agreement, and when you when we progressively do this, we will enrich more and more uranium, we will have more and more heavy water, and when the Americans, with the stroke of a pen, abolished the sanctions illegally applied, and applied as a punitive, vicious attempt to destroy Iran and its people, the Iranians have said, fine, we'll take step after step until the Americans take the first step towards abolishing its failure to abide by the treaty. If the Americans rejoin the treaty, if the Americans drop all of the sanctions, we will then quite easily and quite simply, with the stroke of a pen from our side, start doing something about the centrifuges and shipping out enriched uranium and heavy water amounts in excess of the treaty. And we will go back to observing it as long as America and the Europeans, the Germans and the French and the British and the Russians and the Chinese, who have the latter two, of course, have criticized American inaction. And they've criticized, as many people have, the Europeans' refusal to abide by the agreement. They have supported removing their companies from Iran. They have refused to provide compensation for that, they, as they promised to do. They came up with a really bad organization, an agreement called INSTEC, which is supposed to provide for essentially barter between different currencies for things Iran needs and Europe needs from Iran. But they do nothing with that except talk about it more than anything else. So that's it. Pretty much, if the Americans observe the agreement, the Iranians will observe the agreement. Okay. That's very simple. Very straightforward, and even enough for Joe Biden and his diminished mental capacity to handle.
Okay, Richard, I got one quick question. Iranian parliament has compelled the Rouhani administration to stop waiting for the other parties to deal to fulfill their commitments. MPs want the administration to keep scaling back on Iran's commitment within the JCPOA. Also, we have the presidential election, and you mentioned in a couple of months. How would you foresee the state of affairs as regards the nuclear deal? We have only 1 minute left.
Well, I think that there has to be a decision made in the current regime in the United States, the current administration, about whether they want to go forward with becoming more and more isolated, or whether they want to return to the JCPOA without the conditions that they're trying to impose on Iran. That's what would be the correct and just way to go forward. Whether or not that's going to happen, given the neocon nature of the foreign policy group that's now leading foreign policy on behalf of the administration, I think is really in doubt.
Okay, on that note, we'll come to the end of this debate show on Press TV. Let me thank our guests. We had from the Answer Coalition, Richard Baker out of San Francisco, and also we had author and former U.S. diplomat Michael Springman, who joined us out of Washington, D.C.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum. Peace and blessings of Allah be upon you all. This is A to Z, coming to you from IRIB English Radio, and I'm your host, Ali. This radio show is about Islamic lifestyle, and in each episode, we will be talking about a different lesson. Please stay with us till the end of today's program. Today's lesson, not committing a sin. A sincere Muslim gives primary attention to doing good deeds. As we know, even the best of us may sometimes fail to reject a tempting poor choice. Instead, a blameworthy deed is about to be committed. If a person ends up not committing the intended sin, after having determined to do al-adlm, which is, you know, strong determination, he or she falls into one of the following categories regarding that intended action. Number one, a person who leaves the intended bad deed undone out of fear of Allah. That is, for the sake of pleasing Allah and intending to conform to what Allah requires. In such case, this person is awarded and rewarded for changing his mind and, in the end, determining not to do that bad deed. Number two, a person who leaves the intended bad deed undone out of fear of people. Now, in this case, it's not Allah, it is the fear of people. In such a case, this person has, even so, still committed a sin, a blameworthy act of heart, while leaving off the action of the intended sin is a rewardable act of worship. Still, it is rewardable only when done for the sake of pleasing Allah, not for the sake of looking good in the eyes of people around him. Whatever and whether they be fellow Muslims or non-Muslims. So see how these two scenarios, the only thing that changed was in one case, the person did not commit a sin for the sake of Allah. In the other case, he did not commit a sin for the sake of people. And the end result is entirely different. We're going to go over three more scenarios with you after the break. Welcome back, dear listeners. We discussed two scenarios of not committing a sin before the break, and now let's talk about the third one. A person who has determined to commit the bad deed but fails because he's not actually capable of carrying it out. He may be prevented by circumstances beyond his control. In this category, he doesn't seek the means to overcome those circumstances. Perhaps he simply loses interest for the time being. In such a case, this person is accounted as having committed a bad deed due to his having determined to follow through on something he had weighed in his heart and decided to go ahead. Now, number four, a person who fails to commit the bad deed because he's incapable of doing so. In this category, unlike the previous one, he seeks, but unsuccessfully, the means of committing it. In such a case, a full bad deed is written to the account of this person because having the will to commit a sin is like committing it. In this case, he did not change his mind about trying to follow through the first category, nor did he stop seeking the means to fulfill his intention. Last but not the least is a person has a continuing intention and determination to perform a blameworthy deed. That person is punishable for it. Whether his continuing intention came before his first success at the bad deed or again after the further successful repetition of this bad deed. So if a person commits a sin and then he intends to do it again when he again has the opportunity, this is a person who insists on committing sins. In that case, he is punishable for this intention even if he never actually succeeds again in committing the sin. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Another weekend of protests in the UK, the southwestern city of Bristol, the front line of the battle against the British government's new policing bill that places new limits on protests. Demonstrators could face new fines of up to 10 years in prison for damaging a statue or memorial. The peaceful demonstration descended into violence at some point. Police were pelted, protesters pepper sprayed, and charged at with dogs. 10 were arrested. Thousands took to the streets across Britain. In Manchester, they blocked the tram lines. They were forcefully removed. 18 of them arrested. The UK police cracked down on protests since the murder of a young woman, allegedly at the hands of a police officer, has been under scrutiny. Critics have accused them of using deliberate and orchestrated tactics against the protesters. Last week, police retracted their claims that some officers suffered serious injuries during attempts to disperse a similar protest last weekend. But the government has remained uncompromising. Since the violent clashes in Bristol, it's condemned the protesters. Prime Minister Boris Johnson has called the clashes disgraceful, and his Home Secretary Priti Patel described the protesters as thugs intent on causing trouble.
The contentious bill is still being debated in the UK Parliament. Critics say it gives draconian powers to the police, curtails freedoms, and does too little to protect women and girls. So far, the government has shown no sign of changing course, and those protesting against the bill say neither are they. Saeed Puriza, London.
Bahrain has hosted yet another Formula One Grand Prix. British athlete Lewis Hamilton added to his well-deserved fame by winning the first race of 2021. But in the run-up to the event, Hamilton used his platform to raise awareness about human rights abuses in the country. In November, he received a letter from the son of Bahraini political prisoner Ahmed Ramadan, asking for the athlete to help save his father from execution. Rights groups say he confessed under torture, a common tactic used in Bahraini prisons. Hamilton has since spoken to lawyers, Amnesty International, and the Bahraini ambassador. On the eve of the Grand Prix in Bahrain, he said,
I don't think that we should be going to these countries and ignoring what is happening in those places, arriving, having a great time, and then leave.
But sports organizations have been doing just that. Civil servant Najah Yousaf was jailed in 2017 for demanding the Grand Prix be cancelled. That year, the event went ahead regardless, and for the next 3 years, Yousaf was denied legal representation, raped, and psychologically tortured in prison. Ahead of this year's event, 61 British MPs urged Formula One's new CEO to establish an independent inquiry into abuses linked to the Bahrain Grand Prix and to meet with victims and rights groups before the race to secure their compensation. Needless to say, that didn't happen.
No one wants to see their favorite sport being hijacked or used as a smokescreen for dark and sinister human rights abuses to continue unchecked. And fans have accused Lewis Hamilton now of politicising the sport because of his solidarity with the Black Lives Movement and his inquiries on the ongoing situation in Bahrain. But people in such highly visible international audiences are, of course, expected to be outspoken when they are benefiting exponentially from the public profile that they have. And they know that their silence will be seen as complicity.
Now Formula One has signed a 10-year, $650 million deal with Saudi Arabia, which, according to human rights organization Grant Liberty, has spent at least $1.5 billion on sports washing, hosting Formula E, the Dakar Rally, wrestling, tennis, the Spanish and Italian Super Cups, and European Tour Golf over the last 2 years. Amnesty International says, like all of them, Formula One will be used to sportswash the kingdom's, quote, appalling human rights record, let alone the Saudi-led war on Yemen that has killed and displaced hundreds of thousands of people and pushed a nation to the brink of famine. Bianca Rahimi, London.
A photo gallery was organized at the Yemeni capital Sana'a to view examples of the difficulties facing Yemenis amid the continued siege imposed by the Saudi-led coalition.
From the first moment, the Saudi-led coalition has directly targeted civilians, including those internationally protected, which under international law should not be considered military targets. Mosques, monuments, museums, hospitals, schools, universities, roads, bridges, ports, airports, everything in the country has been systematically targeted by Saudi Arabia.
The health sector is heavily affected by the ongoing Saudi siege. Recently, many health facilities have warned that the incubators may stop working completely within days due to the severe fuel shortage and lack of power, putting the lives of infants at risk. Saudi Arabia, backed by Washington, launched a devastating war on Yemen in March 2015, killing tens of thousands of civilians, mostly women and children, and imposed an all-out blockade on the country, depriving millions of Yemenis of their basic needs. Yemenis say the United Nations bears responsibility for the lives of millions of civilians, including infants, as it remains silent toward the Saudi war crimes against their country. Abd Latif Al-Washali, Al-Sabain Hospital in Sana'a.
The end of winter means that homeless and poorly housed people can be evicted again. These protesters demand decent housing and the end of evictions. In France, more than 300,000 people are homeless. More than 700,000 people are poorly housed. But 3 million of houses or apartments are empty, and millions of square meters of offices remain vacant, which is a record. These are official figures from INSEE, the National Institute for Statistics. Is there a solution? A French law from 1945 allows the requisition of empty buildings, but the government refuses to apply it.
Public authorities are obliged to give accommodation to homeless people. If not, the government is illegal. Secondly, a law exists on empty buildings, which is still not applied. Entire buildings are empty since decades because the value of these buildings increases more by leaving them empty than by renting the space to people. The state should automatically requisition them.
But instead of organizing decent housing, the French government has spread rumors that it will evict more people than former years, without necessarily providing an alternative accommodation.
Me and my children are housed at my friend's home. My husband is at his friend's home. That's our situation for 15 years. Since more than 15 years, we are demanding a social accommodation to the city hall. That's insane.
In a spectacular protest action this week, homeless migrants deployed 300 tents at the Place de la République. The homeless and poorly housed people demand to be housed in decent places. They say there are enough empty buildings to accommodate everybody. What a dramatic contradiction between these people living in tents and huge empty buildings like the Samaritaine here in the center of Paris.
The COVID makes the housing crisis worse, but the real problem is the speculation on real estate that leads concretely to an outburst of the rents, to the eviction of people so that the apartments can be sold empty.
The police supervised thoroughly this march in Paris. Housing people in empty buildings is apparently touching a sensitive chord. Similar marches took place on Saturday in many French cities and also in 20 other European Union countries. This proves that the housing issue is a global problem that should be resolved not only by the French government, but also by the European Parliament and European Commission. Chris Den Hunt, Paris.
It's not the first time China's foreign minister Wang Yi has visited Tehran. But this time, there's a historic difference. On Saturday, Wang Yi and his Iranian counterpart, Mohammad Javad Zarif, signed the much-anticipated 25-year comprehensive strategic partnership agreement. The Sino-Iranian deal was announced in a joint statement during a visit by the Chinese president to Tehran in 2016. The cooperation roadmap consists of 20 articles covering Tehran-Beijing ties in a range of economic, political, and security areas. There are reports that the pact would see Iran supply China with oil for 25 years. In return, China would invest in Iran's ports as well as banking and telecom sectors, which amount to some $400 billion. The deal has sparked mixed reactions by observers, with some saying the deal is one-sided toward China.
The deal is yet to be finalized, and the detail will gradually be publicized in the future. But what's clear is that China needs Iran's oil. In fact, China has always been a major buyer of Iran's crude oil with or without the deal. So Tehran should be careful what it gains in the new agreement.
Others say the agreement is a geopolitical win against a common opponent, the United States, which is engaged in an economic war with both China and Iran.
The aims of the U.S. maximum pressure campaign is to isolate Iran. And improving relations and having a strategic relations with countries that can resist the United States pressures, countries like China, is going to be essential for Iran's foreign policy. Sanctioning Iran is going to be much more difficult. Iran is dependent on U.S. dollar when Iran's trade with the other side is going to use yuan or other currencies. That's going to be useful for Iran's trade.
China is Iran's number one trade partner, but this economic partnership has been restricted by the U.S. banking sanctions against Iran. In 2020, bilateral trade between the two states was less than $20 billion. Both sides agree that the new pact will pave the way for broader partnership, not only in economy, but in politics and security. It's crystal clear that Iran and China are strategic partners. China continues to buy Iran's oil amid the peak of the U.S. sanctions against Iran. But the new pact is a milestone. Observers say at a time when the U.S. is using its currency as a punishing tool, more countries are expected to jump on the wagon and create a united front as a counterforce to the U.S. economic pressures. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Just ahead of United States President Joe Biden's long-awaited first press conference, Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell made the media rounds claiming that substantial economic progress has been made. However, that contradicted extensive new data from the Fed itself, which found that the economy contracted in February, while their national activity index plunged into the negative for the first time since last April, the peak of the pandemic. The index, based on 85 indicators regarding personal spending, employment, retail sales, and production, has been in the negative over the average of the last 3 months, disproving widespread bullish talk that the U.S. economy is recovering. What is certain is that there was no so-called snapback or V-shaped recovery. Instead, a K-shaped recovery has become cemented, with the wealth of the upper class increasing while the lower and middle classes continue to plunge. Biden recently approved a $1.9 trillion emergency coronavirus plan, but it didn't include a single long-term social program. He also backtracked on key issues such as a $15 minimum wage, student debt relief, and the size of household stimulus. This week, top pollster Ipsos found that Biden's approval rating plunged 6 points.
The Democrats do not want to have all the power to run the country, because when they do, it becomes obvious that they're not doing it on behalf of anybody but the ruling class. They're doing as little as they can to keep the pitchforks, to try and keep the pitchforks at home and not disturb the profit-making powers of the profitable industry of healthcare, for example.
George W. Bush, Barack Obama, and Donald Trump all refused to boost the economy of the everyman despite prolonged economic malaise. Failure to remedy the terrible economic data from 2020 and over the first quarter of 2021 could cause major dissension in an incredibly polarized nation.
Fascism comes in on the failure of social democracy. They get angry. There's not even social democracy to fail. They may try social democracy, but they're not at that point yet. They're in control of things. This is one of the reasons I think fascism is an imminent threat, because what do they have to gain by it that they don't already have?
The U.S. is betting that a major coronavirus vaccine rollout will return economic growth to pre-pandemic levels no later than the second half of this year, hopefully. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
Hours after the Yemeni army launched one of its largest retaliatory attacks on the Saudi-led coalition, thousands of Yemenis took to the streets of Sana'a to mark the National Day of Resilience.
The gathering today is the gathering of those who trust in God. These people have proven that they were able to take advantage of the war to develop their military capabilities. Today, our victory is crowned by our ability to stop Aramco by using our strategic deterrent weapons.
Yemenis say the seventh year of Saudi rule will be different as the Yemeni army is escalating its retaliatory attacks against Saudi facilities, pushing the kingdom to stop its years-long rule and to move toward a political solution to protect its oil giant Aramco from Yemeni attacks.
Yemeni people have withstood the aggression surprisingly. The Saudi enemy declared this criminal war from the White House in Washington to bring the Yemeni people to their knees, but they failed because Yemenis trust in God. 6 years ago, Yemenis woke up to the bombing of Saudi airstrikes and the bloodshed of children and women. And today the Saudis and Emiratis woke up to the burning of their oil companies by our missiles and drones. This proves that Yemeni people are getting stronger year after year.
Earlier, the Yemeni army inaugurated the seventh year with the National Day of Resilience operation against several military and economic targets in Saudi Arabia, The operation is the largest so far and used 18 drones and 8 ballistic missiles.
Thousands of Yemenis have gathered to mark the 7th anniversary of Saudi war and siege of their country. They say their army now is capable of forcing the kingdom to stop its deadly war without conditions. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
In the English town of Batley, a local grammar school has caused major controversy after a teacher showed a blasphemous cartoon of Islam's holy prophet Muhammad to students during a religious studies class. Outraged parents of Muslim students began protesting outside the school gates on Thursday, demanding the school take action against Islamophobia.
The incident from Monday, 22nd of March, must also be investigated from a criminal perspective.
Yes.
Given that it was a clear attempt to stir up religious hatred. We also use this opportunity to call upon the entire British Muslim community to review the materials being taught in their children's schools.
Batley Grammar School reacted quickly, suspending the teacher, launching an investigation, and apologising to parents. However, the British press and politicians have opted to condemn the protesters instead, adding further fuel to the fire.
I was disturbed to see scenes of people protesting outside the school. That is not right. We shouldn't have teachers, members of the staff of schools feeling intimidated.
The creator of the universe, Allah, the most merciful, doesn't need a crowd hanging around outside the school.
Many details about what the protesters have been demanding are not clear. Press TV spoke to locals to find out more.
As far as I know, the parents have been very, very responsible. I mean, many of the protesters are not even parents, and the parents have acted very responsibly, very, very professionally, and they should be commended. You know, they're basically the victims of this situation, but they're also the stars of this situation, that they've basically acted in a calm, collective manner. They've not made any unreasonable demands to the school. They've not asked for anything untoward to happen towards the teacher. They've been very, very responsible, and they should be commended for their stance and for their actions.
The school has acknowledged that the resource used in Monday's lesson was completely inappropriate and had the potential to cause considerable offence within the community. However, many online are now arguing that Muslims need to accept insults on the Holy Prophet as part of freedom of speech, and if they don't like it, they have to essentially lump it. However, with further Muslim action planned elsewhere in the country, and also the media continuing to hype up the story, it's likely that things will continue to escalate going forward. Robert Carter, Batley.
After firing two cruise missiles, North Korea launched two ballistic missiles early Thursday morning. U.S. President Joe Biden responded.
There will be responses if they choose to escalate. We will respond accordingly. But I'm also prepared for some form of diplomacy, but it has to be conditioned upon the end result of denuclearization.
The latest launches are widely considered to be in violation of UN Security Council sanctions against Pyongyang, which are strongly supported by the United States and limit North Korea's ability to develop its economy. North Korea's recent missile tests demonstrate that maintaining the status quo in terms of ongoing United Nations Security Council sanctions is unacceptable to Pyongyang. And experts agree that the timing of the tests was clearly designed to influence the Biden administration's ongoing North Korea policy review. Experts argue that the U.S. needs to live up to the Singapore summit agreement between former U.S. President Donald Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, which was violated with recent joint U.S.-South Korea military drills.
From North Korea's perspective, the South Korea-U.S. military exercises, pressure on human rights, and sanctions are threatening. Pyongyang needs to be guaranteed the right to live. If the U.S. has a sincere attitude before approaching North Korea, they will get a response.
U.S. officials recently toured the region to consult allies, with expectations the Biden administration's new policy toward North Korea will be announced within weeks. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Limelight. Vladimir Putin, Angela Merkel, and Emmanuel Macron discussed Russia's Sputnik V vaccine and its use in Europe on a conference call on Tuesday, 30th of March, according to the Kremlin. Moscow's statement said that, among other subjects, the Russian, German, and French leaders discussed prospects for the registration of the vaccine in the European Union and the possibility of shipments and joint production of Sputnik V in EU nations. It did not say who raised the topic. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian's Europe correspondent John Henley. The piece is titled Merkel, Macron and Putin in Talks About Using Sputnik V Jab in Europe. Stay with us for more of the article by John Henley. Vladimir Putin, Angela Merkel, and Emmanuel Macron discussed Russia's Sputnik V vaccine and its use in Europe on a conference call on Tuesday, 30th of March, according to the Kremlin. Moscow's statement said that, among other subjects, the Russian, German, and French leaders discussed prospects for the registration of the Sputnik vaccine in the European Union and the possibility of shipments and joint production in European Union nations. The statement did not say who raised the topic. The European Union's sluggish vaccine rollout has been dogged by an early shortage of doses, but those shortfalls were expected to ease significantly from the beginning of next month, with more than 300 million doses of Pfizer, BioNTech, Moderna and Johnson & Johnson and AstraZeneca vaccines set to arrive in April, May and June. The German government confirmed last week it would be open to using the Sputnik vaccine if and when it is approved by the European Medicines Agency, EMA, with Angela Merkel's spokesman, Stefan Siebert, saying an eventual green light from the European Medicines Agency, EMA, would make the shot worth considering for Germany. Referring to the Russian vaccine, the Chancellor herself said Germany should use any vaccine that has been approved by the European Medicines Agency, EMA, while the German Health Ministry said last week all vaccines are welcome if they have been approved by the EMA. France has been considerably more circumspect, however, with French Foreign Minister Jean-Yves Le Drian last week accusing both Russia and China of using their vaccines to gain influence and score points abroad. Jean-Yves Le Drian told France Info Radio, "In terms of how it is managed, the Sputnik vaccine is more of a means of propaganda and aggressive diplomacy than a means of solidarity and health aid." Thierry Breton, the French European Union Commissioner who heads the EU Executive's Vaccine Task Force, has also said the European bloc has absolutely no need for Sputnik V vaccine, since it clearly has the capacity to deliver 300 to 350 million doses by the end of June. The Sputnik vaccine manufacturer responded aggressively, saying in a series of Twitter posts that Thierry Breton was clearly biased and demanding, "If this is an official position of the European Union, please inform us that there is no reason to pursue EMA approval because of your political biases." European regulator EMA launched a rolling review of Sputnik V vaccine earlier this month, a step towards it being approved as the first non-Western coronavirus jab to be used across the bloc. European Union experts are due to visit Russia in April to check the results of clinical trials and inspect the production process. Russia registered the shot in August before large-scale clinical trials, prompting initial fears about the safety of Sputnik V. But reviews since then have been largely positive, with The Lancet publishing results showing the vaccine is safe and more than 90% effective. Russian manufacturers have not so far managed to increase domestic production to meet demand at home and abroad. But the Russian government has said the country aims to produce 178 million individual doses of Sputnik V vaccine and two other vaccines, the Epivac Corona and the Covivac, by the end of June. It has also said it hopes to fully vaccinate 30 million Russians by the same date, leaving a possible 118 million domestically produced vaccine shots available for export. It also has reportedly set up production deals with 10 other countries to produce its vaccines outside of Russia. Russian pharmaceuticals company R-Pharm said last week it expected to begin joint production of Sputnik V vaccine in its plant in Bavaria in southern Germany, with doses starting to become available from June. France and Spain have also been named as potential production sites for Sputnik V production within the European Union. The three leaders, Vladimir Putin, Angela Merkel, and Emmanuel Macron, also discussed the conflicts in eastern Ukraine, Libya, and Syria, according to the Kremlin statement. The statement said Putin also responded to questions about the jailed Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny during a frank and businesslike discussion. Meanwhile, Russia's Sputnik V vaccine appears to be gaining acceptance in European Union as the head of Germany's regulatory authority publicly praised the COVID-19 jab, and Italy could become the first European country to produce the Sputnik V vaccine from the summer. Thomas Mertens, the head of Germany's Standing Commission on Vaccination, described Sputnik V in an interview as a good vaccine that will presumably also be approved in the European Union at some point. Russian scientists are very experienced in vaccines, Thomas Mertens told Rheinische Post. Sputnik V is a very clever construct, he said. Russia drew criticism last summer when it approved Sputnik V for widespread use after less than 2 months of human testing, amid fears that Kremlin was hoping to leverage the vaccine as a soft power tool. But large-scale clinical trials, results published in The Lancet in February of this year, deemed the vaccine to be safe and offers about 92% protection against COVID-19. The Russian Sputnik V jab is being assessed by the European Medicines Agency, EMA, but has already been ordered to put to use in some European Union countries, particularly in Eastern Europe. From July, the Russian vaccine could also be produced inside the European Union after a deal was struck between Adyen, an Italian-Swiss pharmaceutical company, and the Russian Direct Investment Fund. Depending on approval from Italian regulators, production could begin at the company's factory in Caponago near Milan in July, with 10 million Sputnik doses expected to be produced for export to non-EU countries by the end of the year. Vincenzo Trani, the president of the Italian-Russian Chamber of Commerce, which helped bring the deal together, hailed the move as historic and said it would help create jobs in Italy. Trani added that agreement reflected the healthy state of relations between our two countries and underscores how Italian companies can see beyond political differences. The Italian government was reportedly not made aware of the deal although the Ministry of Economic Development said it was a legitimate operation. Attilio Fontana, the president of the Lombardy region in Italy, said the agreement was good news. Sputnik will not be made available for use in Italy unless it is given approval by both the European Medicines Agency, EMA, and the Italian Pharmaceutical Authority, AIFA. Leading